So, enough breakfast? I was teaching a retreat in Auckland, in the Franciscan Friary. One lady was in charge of my breakfast. She's a very, very good friend. And as the retreat went on, my breakfast started with one tray. And you would have a few things. I think by the sixth day there were three trays. More and more. And there was first one piece of bread, then there was two pieces of bread, then there was coffee, then there was coffee too. Then there was milk, then there was, you know, it just kind of kept escalating as she got more and more devoted to giving me breakfast. And around the sixth day I was just looking at this vast array of cutlery and dishes and food, of which I could maybe eat 10%. And my mind said, yeah, but I want two coffees. just would not be satisfied. That's the way the mind, you know, like, it was really interesting to see this, the kind of, no, it's not enough. And you notice when you have a lot of choice sometimes, you know, you have like 20 flavors of yogurt, you can't find the one you want. Something about our society which gives us so many choices that it really, well, you begin to see you can never satisfy that part of consciousness. You know, greed is just that way. Well, when we talk about mindfulness, one of the inherent things in the definition of mindfulness is the idea of recollection. You recollect the Dhamma. So it's not just being careful not to spill the soup when you carry it up the stairs. It's more than just being careful. It has this idea of recollection of the Dharma. So let's say you meet someone for the first time and your first impression is that you don't like them. Some people say, well, my gut impression, I always go by my gut impression. I don't know about you, I'd rather go with my heart impression. But anyway, if you're recollecting Dharma, then not only are you aware that your first impression is maybe, say, negative, I don't like the person, but you're bringing in Dharma is unsure. This is unsure, this is uncertain, this is a perception. If you don't recollect Dharma, then it becomes a kind of reality. This person is that way, and I am this way, a kind of fixed reality. And what I saw, like with Ajahn Chah, was the way he would relate with people, he would bring out the very best in them. Because he was so compassionate, he would bring out a lot of love from people. Because he was so diligent, he would bring out a lot of determination in practitioners. But other people were the same people would bring out different qualities. So who's the person? Who is it there, right? So just the idea that mindfulness and recollection are conjoined. And what are we recollecting? We're recollecting the Dharma. And what I've been emphasizing is not just to keep it at some kind of intellectual idea. This is the problem with Buddhism. It has such a beautiful intellectual structure that people just get stuck on trying to get the definitions right. So things like the five khandhas, which we talk about as a way of talking about the mind-body experience. You hear endless kind of discussions about what those words mean. And it just remains very, very intellectual. But recollection is actually quite silent. It's just a noticing of Dharma. So I have the perception of someone I don't like, and I can say, oh, this is a perception. It's uncertain. That's Buddha knowing Dharma. So when we take refuge, Bhutang Saranam Gacchami, Dhammang Saranam Gacchami, one way to look at that is Buddha is that which knows what's going on, and then recollection gives it that perspective of the natural law. And the natural law is that your perceptions are the condition. You can feel in a good mood and perceive from that good mood. You can be in a bad mood and perceive from that bad mood. Another person can just be in a bad mood at that moment because they're exhausted, tired, and they just, you know, had some argument with someone, and they're in a bad mood, and you know, they've had the flu and so on, and you see them, you think, oh, that's a bad person. That's some kind of fixed reality. But if you're using this idea of awakeness and recollection, then this is a perception. It's not a fixed person. This is uncertain. And you can still be aware that that's there, it might have value. So as I said, like if you have a plumber and the plumber builds you a shower that leaks and the toilet that doesn't work, then your perception that he's a rotten plumber might be helpful. Right? It's not kind of dismissing that kind of worldly part. Yeah? But that he's a rotten person for being a rotten plumber, that's something you add to it. So this capacity to awaken and know this movement of consciousness as things which depend on other things. And so one of the teachings we have, the first monk I met, Rinpoche Nyanasuchi, who became Bodhisattva, he used to say, if there was probably one word a couple of words that the Buddha used the most, and it would be, it depends. And if you observe how your mind, how consciousness works, how the things that flow through you work, you'll notice that it's kind of depends on, like, in the morning, if you're not a morning person, you feel grumpy, right? If you're not a night person, if the talk goes on too late, you feel grumpy. It's just, you know, it's just the way, it depends, right? But if you don't see that, well, with morning as condition, there is a grumpy nature, you don't recollect that, you don't reflect that, you think it's a reality, and you go, oh God, I don't want to be here, and blah, 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 blah. And it becomes a kind of reality, because there isn't mindfulness and recollection. So it depends. So grumpiness depends on causes and conditions. If you feel inspired, you know, something happens in your meditation, which is, you know, feels very fruitful and works well, and then you have a sense of accomplishment. So the sense of accomplishment comes from that. From the, you know, the work you've put in and so on, so you feel inspired and you want to really do the work and you kind of dedicate, yeah, I'm going to really do this year. And then 2 days later, nothing works, right? You just, you know, you can't sit still for 5 minutes or whatever and you think, oh, I'm no good at meditation. It just depends, it depends. Now that which doesn't depend is the knowing, right? The knowing and the recollection knows that inspiration arises because of causes and conditions, and despair arises because of causes and conditions. But that which knows that is where your real freedom lies, not in these condition-dependently originated things. So then, from understanding that, the question you can put to yourself is, as you're practicing, is what causes and conditions can I create now for peace to arise in the future? Rather than just being hung up on what's coming up now or being kind of blown away by it or whatever. So what could I do right now that would be a cause for peace in the future? And then you see. So if your mind is feeling, like if your heart's feeling very, very open and relaxed, you say, oh, okay, so how can I encourage that? So you do some metta practice. Or if you're feeling very kind of despair, like self-disparagement, you're kind of putting yourself down because of something, yeah, well, that's not skillful. And then you go to the breath or whatever. So you keep creating the causes and conditions for peace, and then peace has to be in the natural consequence. And as the peace of the conditioned world becomes more solid, as it were, then the peace of the unconditioned, that kind of that background clarity of mind becomes more and more apparent. There was one question in here about, let me see where it is. Like a lottery here. What is the, is there any way to minimize one's bad karma done in the past? Well, like the idea of karma, I like to look at that as a agricultural analogy rather than a crime and punishment analogy. All right? So quite often when we look at karma as crime and punishment. I broke my leg because I kicked a dog in a past life, right? Crime, punishment. I mean, I don't know how it works on that level, you know, but I know how it works right now, moment by moment, moment by moment. And I know that if there are intentions in my heart and in my actions and in my speech and my thoughts, which are wholesome, I'll get a wholesome result. I know that. I know that internally. Externally, I don't know. To some extent, I know. I know socially that if I'm considerate and patient with people, I'll tend to create a society which is tolerant. If I'm impatient and demanding of people, I tend to create a society which is more that way. Not totally, you know, not totally, but to some extent I have some influence in society. So if I take an agricultural analogy rather than a crime and punishment analogy, then the way my mind, one of the nicest formulations of that I found, which I mentioned earlier, is that plant an action, reap a habit. Right? Plant an action, reap a habit. Plant a habit, reap a character. Plant a character, reap a destiny. So you can see that if I suffered a lot from cynicism, it's a kind of way to be clever in the world. And so when I came into monasticism, there was a really strong cynical streak. So I had planted that habit how many times? I don't know, right? And I didn't understand. I didn't know. And just, you know, the mind, for cultural or whatever fearful reasons, it would go to a cynical commentary on life. So, and each time I thought in a cynical way, heedlessly, I planted the seed for the habit of cynicism. So that was what I began to reap. And then, of course, as I planted this habit more and more, then the character is more and more cynical. And then my destiny, my worldview, becomes that. And then I kind of come into monastic life, and I see someone really like a beautiful being like Ajahn Chah and these delightful Thai people who are taking care of me, who have this tremendous sense of devotion. And then all of a sudden that cynicism is mirrored. Ooh. And I begin to notice that, this is cynicism. Right? So then I begin to see that, okay, I have to make intentions. I have to be aware of cynical intentions and abandon them. And I have to somehow cultivate intentions which are not cynical, like metta. Metta's not cynical. May I be well, may you be well. And that is a struggle, you know, certainly. You know, like when I came in monasticism, I was pretty young, but my character was, you know, it had some pretty stubborn character traits, right? So then in mindfulness, practice and recollection. So I'm recollecting, okay, what has come up now? Is it skillful or unskillful? And what intentions can I make which are conducive to peace? And so in my case, what kind of intentions can I make where the cynical mind doesn't dominate my life? Because that was a very unhappy way to live, very joyous way to live. And kind of in its cleverness, it was stupid. You know, it's kind of a conceit and arrogance there going on. So then, of course, my mind would go to self-disparagement. You shouldn't be cynical. But that's, again, another character trait, which is unskillful. Right? So that's the struggle I think we all probably go through in some way, right? We have these different character traits. And so the recollection is not a judgment on this movement of character and habit and so on. It's an acknowledgement, a waking up to. And then from there, from that clarity of mind, you have intention. So the word kamma is conjoined with intention. Thought has intention behind it, speech has intention behind it, and action has intention behind it. So intention is synonymous with kamma. Vipaka kamma, we say, is the resultant of that intention, or the resultant kamma. So in so that's how I live forward. So I, you know, I like to look at the law of karma living forward more than living back. I like to front load it rather than back load it, if you see what I mean. But say, let's, you know, if you think about the backward part of it, the resultant karma, the doubts we would have is like, I can see that all intentions that I make right now seem to have a result. But are all the results I get coming from intentions? You see what I mean? I can see that right now, if I speak kindly to someone, I'm aware of that, that I have a result of empathy and harmony with the person. If I'm unaware and I just put them down, then I have regret and they don't like me and so on. I can see that. Right? So the other, from the back end, if someone doesn't like me and puts me down, does that mean that in some past situation I put them down? Don't know. Don't know. That part I don't know. That's not available to me. If maybe if I was a psychic, you know, I could maybe read into that, but I don't know. So I think I need some humility there to say, don't know. But what I do know is that I can like, if you go back to the agricultural simile or analogy, that if I create the kind of ground or the soil which is fertile for the wholesome, but not fertile for the unwholesome, then that's probably the best I can do. So if I keep the precepts, right? And that's a fertile soil for the wholesome, but it's not very good soil for the unwholesome. So I keep the precepts, and let's say I'm tempted to, I don't know, steal something. Like I'm at the office, and everyone's, you know, getting kind of computers from the back store, or taking free paper, or, you know, well, everyone else is doing it, right? Or cheating on taxes and so on. And I decide, no, the precept is not to take that which is not given, right? So that's the soil for integrity, right? But also doesn't give any soil for harmful impulses to take root. So a harmful impulse might come up from who knows where. No one will notice, right? No, but you notice, of course. No one will know. And so I get sucked into some kind of, you know, kind of corrupt mentality in the office space. And I get, you know, let's say like an extreme example, an embezzlement or whatever. And then that all comes out. And I suffer from that. So that impulse to hurt or to steal or to be heedless in some kind of way, to run away from life with drugs or whatever, I protect myself from that impulse. And so I don't allow the conditions of negativity to take root. I might get hit by a meteorite or lightning. Meteorite, probably low probability. I probably will get cancer or Alzheimer's, or I'll get something. That just seems to be part of getting old, right? So things might happen. And I don't know why things happen, absolutely. I don't have access to that. But if I do my very best, then that's all I can know. So there's a certain amount of humility necessary rather than trying to figure everything out. So I think from an Asian perspective, in Asian cultures, quite often that sense of crime and punishment is quite strong. You know, I'm getting this bad karma because of some kind of bad action. But it can be a way of acceptance. So that's what I've seen with, like, you know, someone who's had a tragedy in their life from a more Buddhist background. I've seen them, they say, oh, this is the karma of our family. And it's brought them to acceptance. Now, I think in the West, quite often, if we haven't seen it, we won't believe it. Right? If I haven't seen it, I won't believe it. So we don't take that on board. But if you think about it, all of us live by a narrative. All of us have a story. Even Dawkins has a story. Dawkins says there's no God and we're all just selfish genes or something. Isn't he the guy, right? But that's still a story. Does he really know? You know, he has an opinion and it's clever and he voices it very cleverly and very loudly. There is no God and you know, so on. But it's still just an opinion. I doubt if he's a psychic. So he has a story, he has a narrative, right? So just to kind of say that my narrative is more correct than the Buddhist narrative is a kind of conceit. So what I do is, well, yeah, why not have a narrative? Because the narrative that, well, there's no past lives and there's no future lives, it's just this is another narrative, it's another story, another position. So I like that idea of, well, it's a working hypothesis. And then that makes me contemplate, well, what if it is true? What if there is previous life? And what if there is future life? And in some kind of complicated way, which I cannot figure out, maybe it's true. And what if I just pick up that narrative? Not as a blind belief, but as a kind of working hypothesis. What would that mean in my life? What would that mean in the way I'm dealing with things? Well, there may be something very complicated comes up, very difficult, which I don't know from where. So, okay, this is my karma. This is something I have to work on for some reason. And maybe it brings me to a sense of acceptance. Maybe if I'm really guilt-bound, I think, oh, I'm a terrible person because I did that in a past life, right? So it compounds my guilt, but that would be an unskillful use of it. But maybe just that kind of narrative, okay, this is something I have to work through, or this is something I had to work through. Rather than it being my fault, say, oh, this is just the way consciousness has been conditioned through past actions. And then I say, okay, well, with this as condition, that arises, what can I do now to maximize peace in the future and minimize suffering in the future for myself and others? So it's a story, right? Now someone kind of argues with you, no, that's not true, then that's their story. And that, I think that's the beauty of a reflective mind. It's not a demand that you believe or a kind of disbelief, but you say, well, this is the teaching. That's what the texts are talking about. That is our tradition. Am I just going to like, and this is from a Western, you know, I don't think Asian people think this, but from a Western point of view, it's, well, I'm only going to take that stuff which I agree with. Well, then you just basically have your own conditioning, don't you? Right? But if you kind of take the challenge, okay, to take those bits of the teaching which might not be so obvious or immediate, and just contemplate, I wonder what that would mean. Maybe there's a skillfulness in that kind of narrative. But it would affect you, it would affect the way you think. So in terms of how is there a way to minimize one's bad karma done in the past? Well, the best way to minimize it is not to see it as your karma. To see it as just karma. To see it as just conditioned phenomena. And to abide in awareness of change. Because that's where you're going beyond karma. And let's say I have some accident. I go to China and I lose my passport and they chuck me in jail for 5 years or something. And I think, oh, my karma, I probably killed a Chinaman in a past life or something. I'm in jail, no. So that's self-view, me, suffering and so on. But then awakening to that, oh, this is a feeling of despair. It feels this way. This is a feeling of whatever. You awaken to that, then you go beyond the self-view and see, oh, this is just karma. This is just the unrolling of events, because consciousness is conditioned that way. And you begin to have a place in your heart which is not just a victim of karma, something which is more profound. And that's the pathway to the transcendent. So when good things happen, you know, bad things happen, always you can reflect them. So what can I do now? What are the causes and conditions for peace in the future? That you can always do for sure. Okay, stretch the legs and do some sitting.